It is Monday, November 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, authorities in Northern California are trying to locate nearly 1,000 people missing following the deadly campfire. Pakistan's prime minister rebuts U.S. President Donald Trump's denunciation of the South Asian country's anti-terror efforts. We get reaction.
While the two sides are engaged in these political rhetoric, on the ground and practically, the military cooperation between the two sides is very much intact.
And a new film looks at the physical and psychological scars of war correspondent Marie Colvin. It's all ahead. Authorities continue to sift through the charred wreckage of California's deadliest ever wildfire, searching for any signs of the nearly 1,000 people now listed as missing after the campfire tore through the mountain town of Paradise. The remains of 77 people have been recovered. Rain is forecast for the area this week, potentially helping douse the flames, but raising the risk of floods and mudslides that will swell the misery of 46,000 people under evacuation orders. Many are staying with family, friends, or in shelters. International Edition's Lori London gets an update on efforts to assist people who have lost everything with Jay Lawrence, national spokesman for the American Red Cross.
Right now, I'm standing in Paradise next to a burned-out shopping center after driving around town with fire officials in the afternoon aftermath of the most destructive and deadliest fire in California history, and it's heartbreaking. You drive down the street and you see houses that are just ash with only the chimney standing. It's unbelievably heartbreaking and just and devastating. There were thousands of houses that were destroyed in this fire. The people are going to have to continue to cope with the aftermath. It does, you know, look like a war zone. As you drive into town, there's scorched earth and just devastation everywhere. We all know about the search for hundreds of people who are listed as missing. And the Red Cross is helping with that, by the way. The way we're helping match family members with their loved ones is there's a Safe and Well website that we have. What you can do is go to safeandwell.org and you can register yourself as safe, or you can search among those who have registered yourself as safe. We've had 1,500 matches so far. That's 1,500 people who have found their loved ones just through this program. And there have been 73,000 searches. So the other way that we're helping is every day people walk into our shelters looking for their loved ones. And if you go into the shelters, you can see where they've posted notices. When you go into a shelter, you can also register on paper with Safe and Well. So right now, we're taking care of hundreds of people in Northern California in our shelters. We're feeding them meals. We're offering them comfort. Sometimes that's the most important thing. But the next big thing that's going to happen, and we don't know when it's going to be, is when the people of Paradise are allowed back. And what's important to us is they should know that when they come back, the Red Cross will be there. The Red Cross will be there providing mental health counseling, because this is so depressing. I was talking to a nurse in one of our shelters today, and some people are suicidal, she said.
Oh, my.
It's that bad. And so that's just one important thing we'll be doing. We'll be providing them a hot meal as they try to clean up and salvage what they can with our emergency response vehicles driving through the neighborhoods. We'll be providing special wildfire relief kits. Wildfires are different from hurricanes. These are special kits that include a rake and a shovel. They include a mask. Masks are very important. They include gloves and bags and all kinds of other things. Eye drops are very important because, you know, you can still see smoke in the air. And then we'll be, again, sometimes the most important thing is to have someone to listen to your story, to listen through, listen to what you're going through, to listen to what you're going through as you return to the town that was beloved to you.
Now, I know there are about 1,200 people in Red Cross shelters across California. How difficult is it to go from someone who had a home of their own to be living with all these people in this open space? I would imagine that in itself would be a difficult thing.
Of course, it's difficult. But what we're trying to do is to make it as comfortable as possible as we can. I mean, we feed them 3 hot meals a day. They have showers. They have health services. A lot of them have lost their prescription medicine, so we try to replace that. Their eyeglasses, we try to replace that. And what's so fantastic, what's so wonderful, is the compassion of Red Cross volunteers. Mm. You see it every day. This is a terrible thing that happened, and people should know the Red Cross is going to be there with them.
Are you planning on opening more shelters or taking in more people? Are they still continuing to show up? What's the status of that?
We have plenty of room in our shelters for more people. We've seen the numbers fluctuate a little bit from day to day. As you said, there were about 1,200 across the state in Red Cross and community centers. So we want people to know that they can come to a shelter, that they can find a safe place, that they can find a place where they can be fed and where they can be taken good care of.
So what are you doing in Paradise today as far as, because I know the shelters aren't in Paradise, they're outside
That's
of Paradise.
That's exactly right. That's right. The people of Paradise haven't been let in. I'm traveling along with a contingent of other people, of other Red Crossers. We're being escorted by CAL FIRE. And you can't really help people the best unless you have a sense of what they went through and what they're about to face when they come back to Paradise.
Jay Lawrence, national spokesman for the American Red Cross. He was speaking with International Edition's Lori London. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. In Yemen, the Houthis cease a missile and drone attacks against the Saudi coalition. A new study reports there are overwhelming multiple effects of climate change. Nissan says its chairman has been arrested for financial misconduct in Japan. And Russia has announced a new criminal case against Kremlin critic Bill Browder. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
What makes a kilogram? Since the late 18th century, the standard which a kilogram has been measured has been based on Le Grand K, a chunk of platinum alloy held at the International Bureau of Weights and Measures Laboratory at Sèvres, France. But now a group of delegates representing 60 countries at the 26th General Conference of Weights and Measures have voted to redefine 4 of the international system of units: the kilogram, the ampere, Kelvin temperature, and the amount of substance known as the mole. Scientists say they use the constants and equations of quantum mechanics to determine the new measurement standards. Rather than base these measurements on archaic standards, they will be defined by natural phenomena, which scientists say will be a million times more stable than artifacts such as Le Grand K. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition remains intact after a minister backs off his withdrawal threat.
Obviously, it is once again reflecting the state of affairs between the two countries. As you know, the relationship has really worsened.
Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan sharply criticized President Donald Trump Monday for questioning Pakistan's anti-terror efforts. He said Washington is making Islamabad a scapegoat for U.S. failures in Afghanistan. In an interview that aired Sunday on the U.S. network Fox News, Trump defended his decision to withhold hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid to Pakistan, saying the country doesn't do a damn thing for us. The president accused Pakistan of sheltering al-Qaeda chief Osama bin Laden before he was tracked and killed by U.S. Special Forces in 2011 during a unilateral Daring Night helicopter raid deep inside the country. Reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad tells me Khan's reaction to the Trump comments about Pakistan.
Obviously, it is once again reflecting the state of affairs between the two countries. As you know, the relationship has really worsened over the last 1 year. And, you know, since President Trump suspended assistance, military assistance to Pakistan earlier this year, both sides have been exchanging critical statements, allegations, and counter-allegations. And that's what we witnessed yesterday from President Trump, that, you know, he came out once again and, you know, accused Pakistan of not doing enough to counter terrorism in the region, particularly in Afghanistan. And that's what really, it appears, angered Imran Khan, the prime minister of this country. And he just took to the Twitter, and in a series of tweets, he just defended his country's record, saying that, you know, Pakistanis have suffered more than 75,000 casualties and more than $123 billion in economic losses. And, you know, he went on to, in fact, allege that it's the U.S. military failures in Afghanistan that have prompted Washington to find a scapegoat, and Pakistan is being made a scapegoat as a result of the U.S. failure. So, as I said in the beginning, that this is the kind of situation that prevails between the two countries, that the relationship is continuously on the downslide, although both sides have been engaged in order to improve the situation. But these statements from President Trump and today Imran Khan's reaction clearly indicates that the two countries are far from really improving the bilateral relationship.
However, the U.S. and NATO are relying on Pakistani land and air routes for sending supplies to their own troops that are in Afghanistan.
Yeah, that is actually why most analysts believe that these statements from President Trump and, you know, from the Pakistani side are very nearly politically motivated, because the United States and NATO, they heavily rely on these land and air routes, according to Pakistani officials. Since 2001, more than NATO and U.S. together have conducted more than 2 million sorties, air operations over Pakistani airspace, and more than 150,000 containers have crossed through Pakistan, ferrying key supplies to the troops in Afghanistan. And, you know, Afghanistan is a landlocked country, and currently that's the only reliable route that NATO and U.S. forces are really dependent upon, because with the relationship in, the relationship between the U.S. and Iran is already has plunged to new lows, and there is the same is the condition with Russia. So any reliance on the northern route that brings to bring supplies into Afghanistan, which is comparatively a very long route, is out of question at the moment. So again, it's the Pakistani land and air routes that NATO will continuously need to sustain the military operation led by the United States in Afghanistan. So it is expected, you know, many analysts believe that while the two sides are engaged in these political rhetoric, on the ground and practically, the military cooperation between the two sides is very much intact, and they, you know, a complete breakdown in the relationship is, many believe, out of question.
Is it known at this time, are there any plans for these two leaders to meet, for Khan and Trump to meet?
Well, look, it is really, you know, in the foreseeable future, there's not going to be any such possibility unless and until the relationship is restored, particularly the military aid and military cooperation in terms of training Pakistani officers in U.S. military institutes remain suspended. So unless and until that is restored, unless and until, you know, there is some kind of a political engagement at the highest level, it's very unlikely that there could be a meeting at such a high and such at the highest level between the two countries.
Ayaz Ghul reporting from Islamabad, Pakistan. Israel's ruling coalition remained intact Monday after a key minister backed off his threat to withdraw his party from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government. Education Minister Naftali Bennett had pressured Netanyahu to name him defense minister, but said his Jewish Home Party would drop all of its demands and give the prime minister a chance to get Israel to win again. Netanyahu, facing growing pressure to call early elections, Sunday appealed to his Likud coalition partners not to withdraw their support.
מניסיוני אני אומר לכם שאנחנו נמצאים
Netanyahu, speaking from defense headquarters, where he assumed the defense portfolio after his defense minister Avigdor Lieberman resigned, said the country is in the midst of one of the most security-sensitive situations. And during a period like this, you don't topple a government. University of San Francisco political science professor and chair of Middle East Studies, Stephen Zunis, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, the prime minister's latest political woes were the result of a military incursion into Gaza a week ago, not of his making.
You had the defense minister, Lieberman, engaging in this risky operation in Gaza while the prime minister was in Europe for the commemorations of World War One. It was a botched operation. They ended up both killing the Israeli operatives and some top Hamas officials. And Hamas, of course, retaliated with the rocket attacks, and Israel retaliated with heavy bombing and threatened to escalate. Netanyahu put a stop to it. And Lieberman's upset because he, frankly, wanted to go to another full-scale war. And so it's a bit odd to see that Netanyahu is in trouble for being too moderate on such matters. But this is the most right-wing coalition Israel has seen. At the same time, it may be to Netanyahu's advantage to move ahead with elections. There are those who believe that that may, in fact, be his wish, because there have been corruption scandals that are growing around him. He has not been directly implicated yet. One is involved the government buying submarines and other vessels. The Navy didn't particularly want or need. They had higher priorities. Ends up there's a lot of bribery going on. But there are three other corruption investigations, which some suspect may implicate Netanyahu himself. Might be a reason he'd want to have the elections out of the way sooner than later.
He's been in power now for four terms. Is the public getting weary of Mr. Netanyahu?
His popularity is definitely declining. Concerns, of course, about the corruption and just the fact that he's been in power so long. But, of course, there are also the longstanding critics on the left who believe his continued policy of a settlement expansion and the periodic armed conflicts with Hamas had not made Israel more secure, that essentially refusing to move ahead with a viable two-state solution that is feared is going to just encourage radicalism. But at the same time, the demographics and other changes in Israel have brought more and more Israelis into the right-wing nationalist camp. It's hard to predict what kind of outcome would occur in the event of an early election.
Stephen Zunis of the University of San Francisco. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Oscar nominee Matthew Heineman's film A Private War, about Sunday Times war correspondent Marie Colvin, who risked her life on the war fronts of Sri Lanka, Iraq, and Syria, brings attention to the danger war correspondents face reporting on the plight of war victims. Oscar-nominated actress Rosamund Pike plays Colvin. Heinemann and Pike told VOA's Penelope Pulu how and why A Private War was the Labor of Love, a docudrama delving into Marie Colvin's psyche.
In war zones, parents go to bed at night, not knowing if their children will see the morning. That is a measure of fear that I can never feel.
In A Private War, actress Rosamund Pike transforms herself into Marie Colvin, a gritty, fierce, inquisitive British journalist who dedicated her life reporting on atrocities around the world.
Stand out. I'm not armed! Journalist!
Losing her left eye from a rocket-propelled grenade in Sri Lanka in 2001 did not slow her down. But the scars of conflict took a mental and physical toll. Rosamund Pike emotes Marie Colvin's inner struggles.
I'm most happy with a vodka martini in my hand, but I can't stand the fact that the chatter in my head won't go quiet until there's a quart of vodka inside me. I hate being in a war zone. But I also feel compelled. Compelled to see it for myself.
Everything. I had to learn to smoke, you know, convincingly, because she, you know, for Marie, everything was better with a cigarette. Every conversation, every car drive. I had to see the way she gestured with her hands. She had these wide apart fingers. I had to work out how the eye patch made her angle her head differently. You know, how she could penetrate and sear you with one eye as good as someone else could, you know, dress you down with two.
Filmmaker Matthew Heinemann looks at the complexity of Colvin's character, her courage and drive to get the story out. He shows how she never flinched, even under Bashar al-Assad's heavy bombardment of the city of Homs in Syria in 2012.
Let me go. Hey, we will freaking die if we go back.
Felt compelled to tell the story of a group of 28,000, you know, civilians in homes who were besieged by the Assad regime, and no one else was doing that. And she felt, as she often did, if I don't do this, then who will?
As a documentarian, Heinemann wanted to give this real-life texture to his film. In a scene when Colvin discovers a mass grave in Iraq, the local women and men gathered around mourning are real victims of war.
And, you know, at the end of that scene, like in any documentary that I made, you know, something unforeseen happened. They started chanting and doing this prayer for the dead.
Rosamund Pike relates a similar experience she had while filming an unscripted scene with a refugee woman huddled with her kids in a safe house during the siege of Homs in Syria. Through a translator, the woman tells Pike how she feeds her baby only sugar and water because she cannot produce milk to breastfeed after the trauma of losing one of her kids to a bomb attack.
The woman said to me, as Marie, and it was caught on camera, she said, I don't want this. She said, please, I don't want this just to be words on paper. I want the world to know that a generation is dying here. I want this, the world to know my story.
Pike says at that moment she felt what drove Colvin. The journalist's grave responsibility to bear witness to people's suffering, no matter the cost.
Maybe I would have liked a more normal life. Maybe I just don't know how.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
I've seen it. It's quite a striking film. Well, that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated one quarter of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. Two-thirds of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life.
or have they? We'd like you to tell us your story by writing or sending videos to our website, Twitter, or Facebook page. Find out more by visiting us at our webpage at voanews.com and then click on Digital Frontier. Tell your story and share it with the world through VOA's Digital Frontier.